Welcome into the Future Sox Roundup. My name is Elijah Evans, and I am joined today by a special guest, Peter Flaherty of Baseball America, a friend of mine, and does wonderful work over at Baseball America on the draft, the college side of baseball, everything in between on that front. So we had Pete on last year. I'm excited to have him back this year and just talk some draft stuff. As we record here, it is Monday the 7th. We're 6 days out from draft day. It's crazy. I'm heading to Atlanta this weekend. Super excited to be there for the draft, the All-Star game. This is just the time where we're, you know, we have ideas, we have players we might like, we have players we're targeting. But at the end of the day, none of us really know exactly what's going to happen until draft day. But one person who definitely knows a lot is Pete. Pete, thanks for joining me, man. How you doing?
Thanks for having me on, dude. I'm fired up to be back. It's one of my favorite shows I do each year in the lead up to the draft. So I'm juiced up to talk with you.
Yeah, we love having you on, man. You've been on with James before. You've been on with me before. We all at Future Sox love your work and love just hearing what you've got to say about the draft. So it's an exciting time, man. We're getting right up. We're within a week of draft time. And, you know, before we get into too much White Sox stuff, obviously we're going to talk the number 10 spot, which is, you know, the White Sox first pick. It's a super interesting spot because there's a lot of directions the White Sox could go, and it's all really going to depend on those first nine picks. But before we get into the White Sox side of things, is there ever, do you remember a time where a team with the number one pick has changed their entire organizational staff a week before the draft? Because I definitely don't. And I'm very curious to see how this is going to play out for the Nationals.
Yeah, a week before the draft, no. But there have been a couple of other instances that kind of stick out that you could sort of draw parallels to. The first being, I guess a sort of parallel is in May of 2006, the Royals fired Allard Baird just 6 days before they were set to make the number one overall pick. They hired Dayton Moore right away. He was working on the draft at the time, actually, as the assistant GM with the Braves, so he wasn't necessarily involved in the 1-1 decision-making with the Royals. So again, not really a parallel. And then back in 2009, ironically enough, also with the Nationals, when Mike Rizzo was initially hired, he was named the team's interim GM. So he was technically in charge when they ended up picking Strasburg 1-1 in 2009. But unlike this year's draft, if I recall, and if my research was correct, because I was 9-10 years old during the draft, so I wasn't really super plugged in, but Strasburg was kind of like a set it and forget it type of pick in 2009, and we do not have that this year. So we'll get into it more. It's interesting because I don't think the players that they're looking at will change at all. Actually, I know the players they're looking at won't change at all, but it's hard to definitively say who they're going to pick wouldn't necessarily change because the guy that makes the ultimate decision is no longer around. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see which direction in which they go.
Yeah, that changes some things for sure. I mean, that obviously, it might be the same selection of names, but it is the person that is going to say the name and definitively is a different person, obviously. So that changes things. Who are the, we've heard a couple of names, obviously. Holiday's been out there. Willits has been out there. Initially, it was Jamie Arnold a couple months ago. Right now, we're starting to hear Cade Anderson a lot after he just dominated the College World Series. Who's the selection of names then among those guys and others that you think are still very much in play for that first overall pick?
You hit on kind of the big three. I think it's Holiday, Willits, and Cade Anderson. I think if you want to make a really tough quote-unquote cut, well, actually, I don't even know at this point. If you asked me yesterday, it would probably be more so down to Holiday and Anderson. But Willits might very well be in the mix. I think the sentiment with Mike Rizzo was that the pick would kind of be a scout oriented pick, looking at tools and all of that. Now that he's no longer in the fold, who knows kind of where they end up going. I still think at the end of the day, it's probably going to be one of Ethan Holiday or Cade Anderson. Eli Willits is still certainly in the mix, but I think the domino effect from the pick, as is the case every year, will affect what happens afterwards. I think if Holiday does not go at one, a popular destination for him and a likely destination for him is pick number four to Colorado. Would be really shocked if he makes it past pick number four. And in turn, if Ethan Holiday goes 1-1, it seems like Cade Anderson is the favorite to go to the Angels. So that's kind of where I'm at tentatively right now. But again, it's so open towards the top that it could go in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I looked at the staff draft over at Baseball America, because you had the second pick in that draft that just dropped, and you ended up being Holiday one, and then you went with Cade Anderson at two. And I think more places than not that I've seen have those two as the top two. In your opinion, behind those three you mentioned, who are the other couple guys that you may see as that kind of upper tier? I know this draft is super mixed, which makes it fun, because there really is a ton of variability in opinions of the whole first round, honestly, which I think we haven't had. I mean, even last year, right? You had a draft where there was a couple guys at the top and you were like, okay, this is, you know, it bounced around in order, but you kind of had a little bit more of an idea of that core group at top. This year, it seems even more mixed than honestly in recent years. Who are the other names that you kind of have towards the top of your board in addition to those three?
Yeah, so on my really just my own personal board and like how I view the guys after that quote unquote big three of Holiday, Anderson, and Willits, Seth Hernandez obviously I think belongs in that group, though I might be slightly lower on him than other people are, not necessarily like low outside the top 10 low, but like maybe outside the top five kind of low. Ivar Arquette and Jamie Arnold from Oregon State and Florida State respectively. And then I really, really like JoJo Parker, a high school shortstop out of Mississippi. He's been he was already viewed in a really positive light and a highly regarded prospect throughout this entire cycle, but he's gained some serious late momentum, it feels like, and I'd be pretty surprised if he makes it outside of the top 10.
Yeah, he's the buzz name. I was going to get there soon, and I'm glad you brought him up, because you went with him at the sixth spot in that staff draft of Baseball America I saw. And he's become a pretty popular name in the White Sox world. Not that you're, you know, from someone who's checking and watching and just our guys at Future Sox, in addition to the White Sox community, Parker's become a very, very popular name for the possibility at that 10 spot. The tricky thing there is I'm not sure he falls to the 10 spot at this point. I think that it seems like it continues to be a name with helium behind it. And I'm seeing a lot of info on Parker in that kind of 6 to 8 range. And in terms of, clearly you value him probably higher than 10, but where do you think he slots in terms of a team fit there if it's going to be before 10 potentially?
Yeah, I think the Blue Jays and Marlins are pretty honed in on the high school shortstop demographic, especially, you know, not to overuse the phrase big three, but like the trio of Eli Willits, Billy Carlson, and JoJo Parker, I think that those two clubs are honed in on. Obviously, Chicago at 10, we've discussed before the show and a little bit now. It seems like I think that they would be thrilled if someone like a JoJo Parker gets there. Yeah. But those are the three kind of predominant names, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what it seems like. We've heard a lot of things about how the White Sox would love to go the prep route. They would love to get one of those tooled out, you know, high-level, middle-of-the-field type bats, right? At the same time, there's a chance that all those guys you mentioned are off the board realistically, right? And, you know, Holiday will definitely be gone by 10. Willits will pretty much definitely be gone by 10. And then it comes down to Parker and Carlson, where I think there's a chance they fall, but I could easily see them going, you know, 6 and 8 or 7 and 8, right? And 8 and 9. Like there's a very real world where both those guys are gone as well. Beyond those names we mentioned, if the White Sox miss out on those four high school, you know, infielders, do you think it's more likely that they were? I am not a huge fan of the college bats in this class. I think we've talked about this before too. Like, I don't see a college bat at 10 that is really worth the White Sox pick there personally. So from there, it's like, do you go with a college arm, like a Witherspoon, like a Liam Doyle, or do you just take one of the slightly next tier of high school guys in like a Case in Cunningham, or Steele Hall is another one that I've heard a lot of buzz around in the White Sox world as well.
It's interesting, and this is going to kind of be like a hedgy type of answer, but I think it all depends on, you know, who's available and what's happened. Because personally, I don't think that Jamie Arnold and Kyson Witherspoon will be available at 10. Yeah. The guy that sticks out to me, and we'll probably talk about him a little bit later on in the show, is Tyler Bremner, not just at 10, but potentially even a little bit higher. Wow. And we'll get into him again. But Kasen Cunningham, I really like. I think that the hitability and barrel skills are akin to someone like a Kevin McGonigal. And I know that's a very, very lofty comp. He does have probably the most, well, Kasen has the best hit tool from a pure hitability standpoint. of any high school hitter in this year's class. Now, I'm not going to put him on par at the same level of where McGonagall was at in his draft year, but he is a plus hitter. He has a knack for the barrel. There's some bat speed there. The impact is lighter than what it was with McGonagall, and it probably always will be a little bit lighter than McGonagall, but there's a very good chance he hits and hits at a really high level as he progresses through professional baseball.
Yeah. So that's interesting you mentioned there. I like Cunningham a lot. I think most things I've heard have indicated he's going to go a little bit later than the 10 spot, but I do see a world where, you know, if those other high school guys we mentioned, Cunningham could be in play from the White Sox just wanting to get a pure hitter and a hitter that they think can really continue to grow as he ages into himself. Is Steele Hall, from what you know, kind of the seems like he's the more raw prospect of a lot of these high school guys, but also 17 years old. There's a lot of appeal to have a guy who's super young on draft day and has that level of upside that a guy like Hall does. It seems like the speed and the hit tool for a Steele Hall are very intriguing going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I for me, I think the hit tool can be, you know, he can be an average major league hitter. I always wonder how much impact he'll be able to get to. But the athleticism and raw tools with him are really, really exciting. Like he's an elite athlete. He'll still be 17 years old on the day of the draft. And he's a comfortably double plus runner. Like he's turned in 80 yeah. run times. And he plays the game with a really, you know, high energy, infectious style. And he has the tools and defensive skill set to be an above average shortstop. He's got an above average arm. Probably closer to a 6 than it is a 55. His short area quickness and kind of quick twitchiness are really impressive. He has reliable hands, and the arm strength is adequate enough where he can make all the throws that he's going to need to be capable of making. So yeah. He certainly fits in that 10 to 20 range. I think the 10 spot would be on the higher end of where, you know, I personally have him
yeah.
and where he could go. But like, if you really want to hone in on it, like 14 to 17, it seems yeah. like a sweet spot for him. And he's a hit over power guy, but he really improved his strength and bat speed over the fall and winter, really just the off season. So the trend is his friend in that regard. So he's not like the most yeah. rhythmic or instinctive hitter. And he'll, you know, he'll need to shore up some of the swing and miss tendencies. You know, I saw it myself down at World Wood Bat in Jupiter in October, especially against secondaries. And that's only going to be more imperative as the quality and pitching he sees, you know, improves drastically. But, you know, there are really exciting tools, and I love, love, love the athleticism.
Yeah, that's an interesting one to keep an eye on. And I think that the appeal with him and from what I've heard in the White Sox circles is there's interest in the idea of a slight underslot potentially at 10, because the White Sox are prepared, just like last year with Caleb Bonnemer, the White Sox seemingly are prepared to strike big at their second pick, which we'll get to in a bit because I want to stick in the first round for now. But if they were to want to go the route of dragging down a high-end prep guy at that 44 spot, then maybe a Steele Hall at 10 could be a guy you could get underslotted, considering that's kind of the top end probably of his draft range, which is just an interesting kind of consideration there. But I want to circle back on Tyler Bremner, because these people that listen to me normally know that I'm a UC Santa Barbara graduate now. And Bremner is a guy that I've watched for 3 years now. So I've been watching Tyler Bremner pitch, you know, in college, 7 or 8 starts a season now for 3 straight years. And I love Bremner, and I think he's a super talented pitcher. But what's interesting with him is top, you know, 2 or 3 college pitcher helium coming into the season. He was up there being talks with Jamie Arnold as, you know, the top 5 type picks at a college. And then a month or two ago, kind of in the college season, he has a little bit slower start to the year. You start to see his name falling into that kind of mid to late first round tier. Lately, particularly the past like week or so, I'm starting to hear a lot of top 10 type buzz on Bremner. Where is kind of the adjustment on his buzz? Because this is a guy, you know, for perspective, right? A mid-major and, you know, the best changeup I've seen personally in person in college ball, but definitely still some questions about his, you know, his fastball effectiveness, the shape on his fastball, and then how effective the slider can be at the next level. What's the Bremner helium of late coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I think just it's due in part to, I don't even really know how to phrase it. I think people are kind of, you know, as the draft approaches, as everyone tends to do, they're kind of digging back in on these guys. And, you know, especially from a scouting standpoint, the decision makers, you know, are going in for their final looks and all of that. So I guess I can't speak for them, but at least from a public standpoint, I think they're realizing, you know, what they have and comparing it to the rest of the class and realizing, you know, there are a lot of really exciting qualities here. Like there's no reliever risk. He's a plus strike thrower. The arsenal for me is really, really exciting. You know, I guess we can run through it really quick, but the fastball, it sits in the mid 90s. With run and ride through the zone, it's been up to I think 98 or 99 this year with a really flat vertical approach angle, which kind of creates this like rise or skee ball effect, especially when he locates it in the top half and the top third of the zone, in addition to the natural carry he already has. The slider flashes above average with two plane tilt. It's got more, probably it'll flash more sweep than depth at times, with some sharpness, and it got a hit around a little bit this year, and he didn't draw as many swings outside of the strike zone as you'd like. I think the chase rate on it was fairly low. But the moneymaker with him is the changeup. Like it's a Bugs Bunny
It's
pitch.
crazy. It's crazy.
No doubt 70. It's one of the best individual pitches in this year's draft of any singular pitch type and any arm. He's really comfortable throwing it to both right and left-handed hitters. It flashes like that trademark falling off the table, tumbling life as it approaches the plate, with also some fade to the arm side. His feel for it is exceptional. And then you pair that again with the plus strike throwing ability. It's a really clean, repeatable delivery that's low effort. And I think with him, with Bremner, is when watching him, what stands out to me, and it's an underrated intangible, or at least undervalued potentially, is sort of that slow heartbeat that he has. It never really seems like the game gets fast on him. And it's really, really easy, and almost inevitable that the game's going to speed up on guys and get fast, whether you're a position player or in the box, what have you. But for me, it always seems like he's in control, on the mound, and he's always in attack mode. He never gets too high, he never gets too low. He's a very steady Eddie, almost calm presence. And I think where, you know, he's not going to blink, you know, if there's some traffic on the bases or if his best stuff isn't working, you know, he'll just kind of adjust. So I think that's really, really impressive and sort of like a very nice cherry on top or final piece of the puzzle to his profile, is just sort of that level-headedness, slow heartbeat, because that's going to serve him well and carry him further than a lot of people realize.
Yeah, 100%. I'm excited to see where Brem goes. This is a guy I've been, you know, following closely in, and I'm rooting for. I've seen some swing and misses on that changeup that I've never seen in college ball, to be honest. It's pretty crazy going to some games this year and just watching some of the swings guys take on that pitch, where I'm like, you weren't even like in the same world as that pitch, and that's pretty cool to see. So I'm excited to see where Brem goes. I don't think the White Sox go with an arm ultimately. Like I think last year it was like, okay, they probably need a bat. But they love the profile of Hagen Smith. He fit what they're doing. He was a mold that they knew they could work with. So they went with Hagen Smith over, you know, JJ Weatherholt, Jack Caglione. Like there were some big bats there that they decided to go the pitching route with because they were confident in their ability organizationally to develop a Hagen Smith. And we've seen, you know, there's been some adjustments. Hagen Smith's having going through some changes this year, but ultimately that was the pick last year. This year, I think it's too clear that they need an upside hitter that for them to go away from that even more than ever. So I do think it's a hitter, but it will be interesting to see if a Bremner's on the table or if a Kyson Witherspoon's on the table, like what that consideration is like there. If it's just like, oh, you know, this guy's going to fly through the minors and can be an arm for us really soon, does that take priority over a, you know, a young high school hitter that comes with a higher level of risk? Aside from just the White Sox pick, who's one guy that you think could maybe sneak into the top 10? And then one that, you know, nobody's really expecting, and then another guy maybe that you think is kind of locked into the projected top 10 that you could end up seeing falling out of that top 10.
Well, we hit on him already. We hit him just now, but Tyler
Yeah,
Bremner
that's
wouldn't
the
at all
one. Yeah.
shock me if he quote unquote snuck in there. And I guess
Right.
if you want more of a drastic statement, it would be surprising, but I wouldn't necessarily be like knocked off my chair if the Angels went with him at two. Like I still think
Wow.
that he's a name that's potentially in play for them at two. I don't think he's the leader in the clubhouse by any stretch. They've
Sure.
obviously been connected to Liam Doyle. Kate Anderson's a popular name there. If he doesn't go at one, I think that's probably what ends up happening if he doesn't go at one. But I certainly think that Bremner is still someone that they're talking about at two, even if it's a bit of a dark horse. And then on the hitter side, Sticking on the college hitting side, Ike Irish wouldn't totally surprise me. And these aren't like crazy hot take names. Like Ike and Tyler are already prominently ranked. But you know, he's one of the better hit power combo guys, collegiately, sort of near the top of the class. You know, with Ivar Ket, he's going to develop. It's pretty easy to envision him developing into plus power. But I think the hit tool with Iva adding a coat or two of polish is going to be imperative, especially, you know, when it comes to cleaning up some of the swing and miss, picking up shapes and seeing spin out of the hand, has been a little bit of a bugaboo. But again, he took a step in the right direction. He posted a career high walk rate, and a career low strikeout rate this year, but, professional baseball isn't going to get any easier. So anyway, circling back to Ike Irish, you know, it's 55 hit, 55 power. And he's got a plus arm, a comfortably plus arm. And I think the question with Ike is where does he fit defensively? And if he wants to keep catching, so it'll be interesting what he's announced as on draft night. But the arm will more than play in a corner outfield spot. He's not going to be some impact, defender, but, I think he's likely a corner outfielder when all is said and done. But you know, there's a, you know, he's a good rhythm. I think there's a solid understanding of the strike zone there. The swing can get a little long, but he does a nice job of staying within the hitting zone. And he's got impressive pure bat speed. And he's done really, really well against college velocity. He's hammered 92 plus. And it's just a really appealing blend of contact ability, on base skills, and power. And so, I mean, at the big league level, he's got a chance to be an above average hitter and a 20 to 25 plus home run guy. And I think just in looking at the board and seeing how things may shake out, you know, team picking in the top 10, particularly towards the end of the top 10, or I guess like the last third of the top 10, even though that's it's not a number divisible by three, he could potentially fit in there as well.
Yeah, no, that would make sense. I mean, I think that that's the one college bat I could imagine the White Sox taking a look at. I don't see anybody else even really being in play there. I think I've heard a little bit of Merrick Houston potentially talk, and, you know, a couple other names that could be in play. I think Arquette will definitely be gone by 10. So then, you know, for me, when I look at the board, I'm like, okay, Irish is the one college hitter I could imagine. I don't think the White Sox go that way, but I do think that's the kind of the one guy that could be in play there at 10. On the flip side of things, any of these top names we mentioned that you could see falling a bit, and is there any kind of reason behind that, or is it just kind of the way the board could shake out that one of those high end guys could fall?
It's a good question. I think it's one that we ask and one that gets answered every year. Inside the top 10, I know in our staff draft, Billy Carlson went a lot later than he'll actually go on draft night. I think he went around pick 16. And like our staff draft, there are teams attached to it, but it's almost like it's Team Flaherty or Team Ponce or Team Collazo drafting, sort of that. So we just draft on, you know, guys that we like and less so based on a team. But Billy Carlson slid to pick 16 again. He'll go before that almost certainly, on draft night. It's hard to peg a guy who is like a definite to slide and sort of what your definition of slide is. I think the way the dominoes fall, Eli Willis could go as high as one. He could go as late as like pick 8. Seth Hernandez could go as high as, you know, inside the top 4 or 5 or so picks. He could go as late as the back half of the top 10. Yeah. We touched on Billy Carlson a little bit, I guess, outside of the top 10. And sort of closer to the top 20, Xavier Nines is an interesting one. And this is just me kind of speculating. This is not me dropping like wink, wink, nudge, nudge hits. I'm just kind of rolling through the board in real time. So there's like a guy that I have circled and highlighted in yellow ink is like a guy that's okay. This guy is probably going to slide on draft night. It all just depends on how the board shakes out. You know, what deals are cut, what guys' prices are. It's just a whole lot of dominoes.
Yeah, that's how it always is. That's the MLB draft for you for sure. About those dominoes, I think that's a perfect segue into the second round, because the White Sox, you know, like I mentioned, there's definitely some talks of really spending on that second pick, which is 44th overall. Last year, you saw it with Caleb Bonimer, who got a signing bonus, you know, at pick 40, I think it was 42 last year. He got a signing bonus that was like a late first round type of bonus. The White Sox overslotted him by almost a million last year because he was a guy with just that type of upside that they wanted to take a shot on. And now we're seeing Bonimer having a great first professional season in single A at 19 years old. So, you know, so far so good. Obviously a long way to go for him still. At that 44th pick, a couple of guys we've definitely heard some buzz on. The first name I want to mention is a local Chicago guy who I don't think gets to 44. I think we'd all love for him to get to 44 from the White Sox perspective. But Jaden Fowski is a high school guy from Nazareth. I've got some connections over at that school there, and I've heard nothing but incredibly good things about Fowski. Where have you heard talks of Fowski? Because I've really heard anywhere from like, oh, he could slip into the back of the first round because of the upside there, or he could be, you know, getting towards the White Sox pick, maybe that comp A or very beginning of, you know, that back end of that first comp picks potentially.
Yeah, I mean, Jaden Fowsk is a really good player. And, you know, he's a guy that has been a momentum gainer later on in the cycle. It's above average power with a litany of average or better tools across the board. 6'3", 220-pound left-handed hitter. You know, there are strong hitting and power ingredients there, and there's a track record of performance at some of these more prominent events. He didn't spend a ton of time behind the dish this spring. I think moving off the position could eventually hurt, you know, his profile with some teams. He was always kind of viewed as a risk to stick a catcher and, you know, potentially someone who could move off of the position, but it's a really smooth and rhythmic left-handed swing. He understands the strike zone. There's impressive plate coverage and contact rates. You know, it wouldn't totally shock me if he goes inside the first 40 or so picks, but I think him being there at 44 in play at 44, I think it's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, that would be definitely appealing, I think, to a lot of White Sox fans, at least, just because I think he's a local guy. You get that excitement. You've heard about him in Illinois for a couple of years now, so there's definitely that intrigue there. Another one I mentioned particularly, there's many of guys, you know, again, like you said, 44, there's 43 picks before, so all those 43 picks are going to dictate what ends up happening. But one with a lot of helium lately is Tayton Gray, another high school guy, prep guy, 17-year-old who's committed to Oregon. He's another kind of catcher, but probably not going to be a catcher from what I feel like I've heard. This is a guy who, you know, I've seen a lot of buzz on, and I think there's a couple people I know in my White Sox world who really like the idea of, even if it's, you know, maybe a bit of a reach on compared to some draft boards, they really like the idea of Gray at that potential 44 spot.
Yeah, him at 44, that's also certainly a possibility. He could even go as, you know, he could even go higher than 44. Yeah. I think that the Orioles have been linked to Gray a little bit in some capacity, as high as like 30, 31 in their string of late first round picks. But he's been another momentum gainer. He's a seriously physical kid. I think he's listed at 6'3", 220, almost like a linebacker-esque build. And I mean that in a positive way. But the impact with him has been really impressive. At the Super 60, he popped a 109, and then at the draft combine, it was the third best max EV of any hitter, high school or college, at 114.5 during batting practice. It's plus raw power, and there's enough hittability there that he's able to get to it and access it in games. There are some moving parts in the swing with a little bit of a leg kick and some hitchiness in his hands. But there's a ton of bat speed there, and the power with him is obviously the calling card. I think, like the case with any amateur catcher, particularly at the high school level, the actions and general defensive skill set needs work. But that will come with reps and time spent at the position. So I'm happy you brought him up because he's another steady up arrow guy.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard nothing but good things. The one arm that I got a couple college guys next, but the one arm I've heard a little bit about, and particularly today, I forgot exactly who reported it, but there was something today on how he could be I'm going to pull it up because I want to try to see who had cited this. There was an interesting piece on, let's see, it was, I think it was on ESPN today, about how if there were to be this kind of, you know, high school guy earlier, maybe you can have the money to float a guy down to the second pick with a big bonus potentially. And Cruz Schoolcraft is the one guy that came up. First of all, a 80 tier name. I mean, that's just a great name. But Cruz is a guy who I heard is, you know, projected higher than 44. But if the White Sox do kind of underslot that first pick, maybe a guy who could pull down potentially to 44. What do you got on Cruz? I know he's technically a two-way, but it seems like he's being drafted as a pitcher from everything I've seen.
Yeah, no doubt pitcher for me, and I think almost everyone else.
Yeah.
But he's got this huge kind of towering 6'8", 215-pound frame. He's a really imposing figure on the mound. And I think with him, you know, obviously the frame is a little bit unicorn-y, and then you add in the fact that he's left-handed as well, and there's a ton of appeal there. He controls his body. I'd say it's pleasantly surprising the body control he has for a high school kid, with that kind of frame. The fastball, it'll sit in the low 90s, and it's been up to 97, but you know, with him, the delivery, and you know, the elite extension that he's able to get, it helps the entire arsenal play up, especially his fastball. Like, the extension is outstanding. It's been up to 97, but it'll look a lot harder than that thanks to the extension. His changeup is his most consistent secondary. It's an above average pitch, and it's one of the better ones in the prep class. It just needs a little bit more consistency. The slider is also an effective breaking ball. It's closer to average than it is above average, but there's enough power and movement there that I think you can project a 55 on it. There's huge raw power for him at the plate, but again, I view him almost solely as a pitcher. Yeah. And I'm of the perhaps naive mindset that two-way players don't exist. Outside, like, you know, Shohei Ohtani is a one-of-one, one-off kind of deal. So, yeah, he's another interesting one. I certainly view him as a guy who will go perhaps before 44,
yeah,
but
I do too.
That's another prime kind of candidate to, I think, watch.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely some other ones. The other high school name I'm watching is Sean Gamble. I've definitely heard some good things on Sean Gamble. I don't know as much about him, and you know, 19-year-old, so a little bit older for high school. And then the two college names, because I think the White Sox would love to go high school or prep, because I think that's what they, you know, where the team is at, where the organization is at. If you can get two really high-end prep guys, I think they would love to do that. If they go prep early, though, and they spend high on a Carlson or a Parker, right, then it goes to college. And then if you're going to college, I think you're looking at a corner guy, a corner bat, or just a legit bat in general. Two of the names I've had circled and I've just heard some things on are Corbin Dickerson and Brandon Compton. You know, Dickerson being a Indiana guy, Compton being Arizona State, college guys, both just outfielders with a lot of up arrow on them. Compton, I know, was a standout at the combine this year, posted some ridiculous EVs in the combine. I think I saw like a 116 max EV from Compton at the combine or something like that. It might've been a little high. And then Corbin Dickerson was a guy who really broke out for Indiana this past year and just showed a lot. So those are two of the names I've heard just mentioned in circles. In terms of if they were to go the college route at 44.
Yeah, I really, really like Brandon Compton. I saw him a bunch last summer on the Cape, and I think what he did there, and he lit it up on the Cape, I think what he did and how he produced there is far more indicative of what he'll look like as a pro than what he did this spring when he had a more modest 278 with 9 homers. But you want to talk about a guy that's built like a linebacker or built like a house, like Compton fits that description to a T. Like, he is seriously physical and barrel chested at 6'1", 225. There's a ton of strength and power packed into it. You mentioned it, but he showed really well at the combine. I don't think that this is like, you know, the combine is good because it helps move the needle on some guys. Like, they won't necessarily announce their I think people were happy with how Brandon Compton performed and how other guys performed. But it's not necessarily going to like skyrocket their stock. But it's a pretty short and compact left-handed swing. There's a ton of bat speed there. For me, it's 70 raw power. I do think he's going to hit enough to get to it in game. The approach sort of regressed a little bit as the spring went on, but
yeah,
I have all the faith in the world that he's going to recapture, at least to an extent, the form that he was able to on the Cape last summer. Like, it is double plus raw, double plus game power, especially to the pull side. It's plus game power to all fields. There's tons of bat speed there, and he actually, he's relegated to left field defensively. That position can only have so much value, but he does move well for his size, or at least better than one would think when looking at him. And there's some sneaky range there, especially to the left center field gap. But I'm a real believer in Compton's hit power combo, and I think that the combine helped him out. Like, he was popping 117s, which I think was the highest EV of the event. And then with Dickerson, the track record with him is really, really limited. He started really hot out of the gate, and then ended up hitting like a more modest 314 with 19 homers. But, he's kind of a tool shed in every sense of the word. He flashed plus power to all fields. I think the 90th percentile EV was 110. It's a quick, powerful swing. He had a knack for being on the barrel this year. The swing can get a little lengthy at times. But I think that there's a chance that he's an above average defender in center field, thanks to his really high level athleticism and plus speed. Those two qualities bode really, really well on the grass. He's got range in all four directions. The arm is average, but the speed and athleticism are going to be what has him stick in center field. I think at like 44, that's rich for me. He more fits in that fourth to sixth round bucket.
Okay.
But in that range, it's a fun bet on the tools and upside kind of deal, because there's no track record to speak of with Dickerson. This year was his coming out party. He was regarded as kind of this tool shed player and was a highly touted prepster, but was buried at Louisville and then flourished this year at Indiana. So he fits in that fourth to sixth round range bucket, but the tools are exciting. I just kind of wonder how much he's going to hit professionally.
Yeah, that's all great info there. I can't say that, a lot of these names I know when I look into. Jack Bauer is another one I've heard mentioned just because he's an Illinois guy, right? That high upside arm. There's been a ton of guys that are that have been floated. Anthony Ianson is one, LSU, who was another one mentioned. When we look at the third round, I guess Dickerson, it sounds like, could be more that later a little bit than second round. So maybe I was a little bit bullish to mention him in the second round talks. But when you look at that third round, pick 76, seven, I believe it is, for the White Sox. There is, 76, pardon me. There's a couple of interesting situations there. And one that I have heard a lot about, and again, I don't think that Parker, that JoJo Parker lasts till 10, but there's this, White Sox fan theory of, you can convince JoJo to go down to 10, buy him down to 10, because then you can take Jacob Parker, his twin brother at 76, right? So an interesting idea there. What is Jacob Parker's profile like as opposed to his brother JoJo, who's kind of that high end guy, and then Jacob is projected in that kind of third round range potentially?
Yeah, so JoJo has this strong athletic build at 6'2", 195. So he's he has an impressive frame himself, but Jacob is, he's got a big league body as well at 6'4", 210 with a ton of raw power. He's one of the best like BP hitters, I think, of any prepster in this year's class. He's posted multiple EVs north of 110 already with Wood. It's plus raw power. And the swing is not super efforty, and he's able to get to it still in game. I think, unlike JoJo, though, there are more questions about the hit tool and his pure hit ability. The contact skills are fine, but the swing and operation, you can get kind of out of sync and off balance in games, and the bat path can get a little bit long and inefficient. So, I think, unlike JoJo, the hit tool lacks polish. Jacob turned in plus run times. I think that when all is said and done, though, he's a corner outfield type of deal. And the above average arm and the power and the body kind of fits that of a prototypical right fielder.
Yeah, that's a definitely an interesting one. I think it sounds like he's got plenty of upside, and everything we've heard is that Jacob has kind of a lot of that power upside that you dream on. There's just a lot more questions there to still figure out with the hit compared to JoJo. Another high school name to mention, and then I'll kind of wrap up just mentioning specific names. But Dax Kilby is someone that I've gotten interested in because I have a buddy who really likes his swing and is super into the left-handed, you know, left side of the infield type profile there. What do you got on Kilby there as a possible kind of? I think he seems like he's a third round potential option there.
Yeah, I think he goes probably earlier than the third.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, if he does go in the third, it's probably that like buy down type of deal that you would reference. You know, I think he's a pretty safe bet to go in at least the second, could potentially go in those sandwich picks, as I kind of like to call them. But you know, you said it, it's a really, really sweet swing from the left side, and there's a pretty lengthy track record of hitting at a high level. You know, he's got a good body at 6'2", 190. There's room to fill out further and add more strength and impact in the coming years. And I think that will only help amplify his already advanced and polished hit tool. You know, it's a compact bat path. There aren't a whole lot of moving pieces and moving parts to his swing. You know, he's consistently on the barrel. And the contact ability with him is really, really strong. And so is the approach and just kind of the general understanding of the strike zone and hit ability. And it's more of like a line drive contact oriented profile. But he sprays them all over the yard, and circling back to the physical projection. You know, I think that he could eventually grow into average power. And I know that might not necessarily perk a whole lot of people's ears up. But if he's able to grow into average power to go along with an above average hit tool, I think that makes for a really appealing profile, even if he does end up needing to move off of shortstop and ends up at second base. The arm is just a little bit light.
Yeah, no, that's great info for sure. All right, well, that's all the names I have particularly. There's some great intel, and obviously there's so many more names that could be in play in that second and third round that we can't get to every single name. But is there anybody on the college that I know you being a guy who's out on the Cape, looking at college players on the Cape Cod League every summer, in addition to just covering college ball consistently, on the college side of things, we talked about a lot of prep guys, but college-wise, anybody kind of stick out to you as someone who you think might be a little undervalued in those you know, mid to late rounds, or just really anywhere past those first few rounds from the college ball side?
First few rounds, I really like Ethan Hedges. I guess if we're isolating, you know, rounds one through three and looking outside of it, I like Ethan Hedges a good bit. He was a serious helium guy just thanks to what he did this year at USC. Like, obviously he was effective on the mound as well, but he's going to be a bat at the next level. He hit 346 with 14 homers, 11 doubles, and he laced five triples and stole 10 bags. There's a really balanced blend of power and plate discipline. It was a 17.4% strikeout rate and a walk rate just over 15%. You know, he's has more upside as a hitter professionally. It's a gap to gap kind of an approach with solid bat speed, and the power plays to all fields. It's neither tool, his hit or his power, is super loud, but I think you can comfortably stick a 50 on both of them, which again, I think that makes for a valuable profile. And it's a 60 arm on the left side of the infield where I think he's got a chance to stick over at third base and a good chance at that. He defends his position well. He moves okay. And I guess also in that range, Michael Lombardi from Tulane is really intriguing. He was also a two-way guy, interestingly enough, for the Green Wave. They just, you know, let him run around this year in center field and let the athleticism play. But he's a no-doubt pitcher for me in professional baseball. The fastball sits in the mid-90s. It's been up to 97. It's got plus carry in the top half of the strike zone. And then he pairs his heater with a plus high 70s curveball. It's got a ton of depth, true 12-6 downer shape, and he'll get whiffs with it, you know, both in and outside of the strike zone. I think with Lombardi, he does check a few boxes of, okay, this kid's a plus athlete. He's got a plus, at least one plus pitch in his curveball. The fastball has plus upside and will flash plus when located in the top half of the zone, but he lacks a third pitch. He'll kind of just, you know, use a mid 80s changeup as a show pitch, and the strike throwing ability is scattered, but the athleticism plus two pitch combo, and just how he moves on the mound, plus his body. He's a, you know, 6'3", 200-pound kid. I think that, you know, that gives people plenty of reason to be excited. And I could keep on going with, sneaky name after sneaky name, but those are a couple of guys that popped into my head right away.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, this is always great intel. I love getting you on here, Pete. I appreciate you making time for us during draft week because there's a ton going on. Where can White Sox fans read your stuff? You got Baseball America and then at Peter G. Flaherty on the old X, right?
Yeah, you hit on them both. I will regularly put out pieces both on the draft and then just, you know, the college and amateur side in general on baseballamerica.com, and then I'm very active over on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, at Peter G. Flaherty.
Awesome, man. Well, we appreciate you so much for coming on and talking draft. I'm looking forward to picking your brains. Well, I'm sure I'll be texting you with when the White Sox make these picks, because after the third or fourth round, I'm not going to know some of the names. So I'm sure we'll be talking a little more. But yeah, again, as always, thank you for joining Future Sox, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Thanks so much for having me on.
Looking to get the most out of your money, time, and even better, your points and miles? I'm Chris Hutchins. I'm a lifelong optimizer, and I've sold two companies, racked up millions of points, and traveled the world to over 60 countries almost always for free. And I host All the Hacks, an award-winning podcast trusted by more than a million listeners that turns big ideas into quick tactical moves you can start using today to upgrade your life, money, and travel. Recent episodes have covered how to book business class seats for economy prices, how to make an easy $3,000 a month from online deals, and tiny habits that you can use to buy back hours of your time each week. There's no fluff in the show. It's just proven playbooks to travel better, spend smarter, and design a life you're excited about. So search All the Hacks, that's All the Hacks, in your podcast app, hit follow, and start upgrading your life today.